Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Blake Amal, and Blake is the chief marketing officer at Copy AI. I previously had Paul Yacoubian on the podcast, and he is the founder of Copy AI. And so I figured, why not also bring in someone who's working with the company? And in this conversation, we didn't speak too much about Copy AI, but we did talk about Blake's mission service and his changing priorities over the years. And it was really cool towards the end of this conversation to hear Blake reflect on how some of the things he once valued, how that's slowly changing over the years. Thought that was interesting. Thought that this conversation was a great one. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed recording it. Thank you for listening. And if you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at HeyDannyMiranda. Looking forward to your feedback. And I'll see you guys Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And without further ado, this is my conversation with Blake Amal.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Let's start off with your missionary work, because I feel like that would be a great place to start.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? And take us through the experience for someone who has never experienced something like that.
Yeah, so I'm a Mormon. I'm one of them, and maybe that gives you a good example of how we're real people too. But when I was 19, I had the chance to say, "Hey, I want to go out and I want to talk about what I believe in." And basically, what happens is you submit an application. It's a pretty rigorous process, submitting tons of information, getting all kinds of vaccines to make sure you're protecting everything. It's a long process. And then the church will come back and say, cool, here's where we need help. And they'll just assign you a place to go. So for context, my dad also was a missionary and my brother, and they both did missions in Washington State. So my dad was in Spokane and my brother went to Seattle. So I was pretty sure I was going to Tacoma or, you know, one of these cities in Washington. But when I opened the letter saying where I was going to go, it said France. And so I was like, well, that's pretty dope. So I went over, I spent 2 months learning the language before I even went over. And then every single day, the schedule was 6:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. You were pretty much out talking to people every day for 2 straight years. No breaks, really, just going out and talking about what you believe in. And so it was a really valuable experience for a lot of reasons. I grew a lot as a person. I was valuable that I got to share what I thought and what I believed. But it also, I didn't realize how much it was going to benefit me in my career, because I can talk to anybody now. I've talked to people that hated me without even knowing who I was. I would walk up to them and they would immediately just start yelling at me. And I was able to eventually get to a point where I could just walk up to those people and just keep a smile on my face, because, you know, I've been through it and it was fine. And they're just people and you don't know what they're going through, and I could still have conversations with them. And that is a super valuable skill. Not that everybody's always yelling at you in your career, but it can happen. And being able to talk to anybody, being able to sell, being able to, you know, put in a lot of work. Those are valuable things that I learned from that experience.
So you're on this, you have the schedule of 6:30 in the morning to 9 p.m. and you're just talking to people. What does that look like? Like, what is a typical day of doing missionary work actually like?
You wake up at 6:30, you do exercise for a half hour, which you do it in your apartment. So there's like nothing there. And when you're a missionary, you're living pretty bare bones. So you're really just like doing crunches for 30 minutes. More often than not, you're just rolling out of bed and pretending to do crunches. You're not really doing anything. After that, you get ready and then you study for about an hour or an hour and a half. And then you get out the door as soon as you possibly can. And you just start walking around. So in France, the way that the cities are there is even the small cities always have a center where there's a real hub. And that's where most of the people gather. throughout the day. So there was a clear place where we could go every single day and just start talking to people, start up conversations. You know, when I was earlier on, I would jump right in and be like, hey, here's what I believe. Do you want to come and come to church with us? And like that, over time, I realized that's not the best way to talk to people. Like if I were selling something to somebody, I wouldn't just start right in with the pitch. I would probably want to tell a story, get to know people. So I started doing that a little bit more, and it was an awesome experience. But we would go into the center of the town and just talk for hours to people, or we go knock on people's doors. That's like the common thing that people think of with missionaries, is we're going door to door. We did some of that. But yeah, there's all kinds of stuff that we would do to just try to talk to people. That was the whole goal every single day. There was some logistic stuff. Like we had leadership positions within that structure so that we could all kind of keep in touch with each other and report what's happening and everything like that. So I was a leader in the mission for most of my time there. But other than that, going to those meetings, it was all just talking to people in the bus, in the streets, in their houses, like wherever.
Could you tell a story of a time when you successfully accomplished whatever you were aiming to do?
Of course. Yeah. So crazy, crazy story. So you have areas that you go to. You don't just go to one city and stay there for 2 years. You rotate around to a bunch of different areas with a bunch of different companions or people that you work with. And so in my very first area, I was in this city that was basically, the whole city was a castle with some suburbs outside of the castle. It's a huge city. It's called Carcassonne. That's going to be hard for the transcriber that you're using to pick up on properly, but that's what the city's called. It's kind of on the border of Spain and France. And we were just going in apartments every single day, nothing happening. People just weren't interested. And then one time we knocked on this door at an apartment. It was at the end of a night. We were exhausted, and we knock on this door. And this woman answers, and she's got a kid in the background. I can tell she's got a cat that's trying to escape out the door. And it seemed like a total bust. Like this was just going to be like every other conversation we'd had that led to nowhere. And she flat out told us, like, we're like, hey, here's this book that we have. It's really cool. You should try to read it. It's going to change your life. And she just wasn't buying it. And so she went to shut the door on us. And we just had this feeling like, we need to stop this. We need to just like try to be persistent a little bit, but just be a little more persistent. So I put the Book of Mormon, I put the book in the wedge of the door to stop her from closing it. Pretty bold move at somebody's house. And she opened and she's like, what? And she just yelled at us. And I was like, you really have to read. It's super cool. It's changed my life. And so she let us in. We chatted a little bit. And then 3 weeks later, she actually joined the church. Mm. So it was crazy. Like we went from total rejection, end of the night. Like that was the last door we were going to knock. And she even told us no. And it just flipped because we just paid attention to this one gut feeling that we had to, no, you just try something else, be a little more persistent. And she listened to the message. And still to this day, she's going to church with her family, and she got married, and her son has joined the church too. And so that's a pretty cool story, like right from the beginning of my mission time. But I've got a ton of other ones that, you know, we could always go over after the fact. I know, you know what?
What gave you the confidence to put your book on that door?
No clue. Because I was still super new. I guess it's probably ignorance because I didn't know what to do or what not to do. I was just kind of in that phase, like, I want to make this work. I want to be the best. And so I just had that gut feeling and I actually did it. Whereas I had times before where I had a gut feeling and didn't act on it. So that it just happened that way. And I had no clue that it was going to work, but it did.
What's the feeling that you get from successfully converting someone or successfully getting them to believe in your mission?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like at the beginning of my mission versus at the end, that the answer is different for both of those. Up front, you just kind of go through this training, and everybody knows, like, you're there to baptize people. You're there to help people get converted. And so that was the goal for every conversation. But that eventually flipped from being like, oh, cool, we got somebody baptized, really quickly flipped the script to just being so happy for them. Because the cool thing about what, you know, what I believe, and I think most people have some kind of belief system that's similar. They just call things by different names and whatever. But the cool thing about that was you could see the light in their eyes change as they were learning more and more. And as you know, whether it doesn't matter, like whatever religion you want to believe in or not believe in, that's cool. I've got no problem with that whatsoever. But when you believe in something strongly and you believe that you have correct principles and you actually live them, and this applies to business too. If you believe you have good principles and you live them, you will be happier every single time, every time. And so when we saw people that started believing in these principles, started living them, they would be happier people. And that's the coolest part. It's not just saying like, cool, we got a baptism, put a check mark there. That's not how it was past like the first month or two out in the field. It was more just, wow, look at how happy they seem to be. Maybe we're onto something here. Maybe we should keep doing more of this. Easier said than done, but that's generally how I'd answer that.
Yeah. And you gave me the transition into business and into, you know, you working for, tell the story of how you get your first job as in France.
Yeah. I was there for 2 years. So when I got back from my mission, I was 21. As you can imagine, everybody else that was my age was already 2 years into college. I hadn't started college. I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do. So I come back and the only skill I have is French. Other than that, I'm totally useless. I don't know anything about computers. I don't know anything about what I want to do. Totally useless, but I speak French. And so I started college because that's what they told me to do. By the way, I dropped out of college. So if anybody wants to talk to me about that, I've got all kinds of opinions, but I did start college because that's what I thought you're supposed to do. And I needed a way to pay for stuff because I didn't get any help with my college or anything like that. I came back and I was like on my own, totally. And it was a rude awakening. So I had to get a job and I just so happened to speak French. And there was this company doing SEO. It called Boostability in Utah. And that was my in. They had a French Canadian team serving French Canadian clients. I just got in doing that. No idea what I was doing. I was just really good at French. And so I made it work. And then I learned SEO little by little, but I kind of didn't like it. And I thought there's no way that I'm going to do this for my whole career, but the joke's on me. Cause that's what I've been doing my whole career.
Well, what did you not like about it?
I thought it was boring up front because the way that we were doing it wasn't, first off, that was in 2013. So that was when it was still a little spammy to do SEO. Like you could still spam stuff. And I didn't really like that. And I couldn't put my finger on it. And now I understand why I didn't like that. But the way that the company was set up was it was more task driven. So it wasn't strategic whatsoever. It was just, all right, here's a keyword. Here's the website. Build a link somewhere on some random site for this. And so you just write random things that you didn't care about. And for French Canadian clients, like most of the ones that we had were shipping container companies. So imagine writing links, writing little blurbs to link to about shipping containers 40 times a day and then going home. It's awful. It's so boring. Like there's nothing there. So that's what I thought SEO was. And that's why I didn't like it. When I moved on to agency life, I started to get into the strategy and understand that it was actually interesting and it was creative alongside the analytical portion, and that it wasn't just like copy, paste, create spammy links, all that good stuff. So I just had to see a completely different side of it to see the fuller picture, because my first exposure was extremely boring.
And what got you hooked on it? What got you, was there a specific moment?
No, I wouldn't say there's a specific moment. It was a very gradual, like even up until a couple of years ago, I still didn't think that I was going to do this forever. I thought maybe I tried to learn to code a few years back and I sucked at it. And I tried a few other things that just, I wasn't actually that interested in. And I just kept coming back to this thing. So that's how I knew that I probably was in the right arena. I just needed to narrow it in a little bit. And the moment that I started focusing more on just creating stuff and using my marketing skills to help that, that's where I really found my sweet spot. So I think marketing is a super powerful tool for creators that doesn't get utilized nearly as much as it should. And that's where I kind of found the bread and butter there that I actually really like and that I can make a career out of. But it took 6 years to get to that point.
What do most creators not know about marketing?
I think the common misconception is that you're trying to manipulate people, which does happen a ton. Like there are 99% of us marketers do ruin stuff. Like that's the common saying that marketers ruin everything. And it's kind of true. We do. But beyond that, if you look at marketing just as a way to get your message out there, such that like it couldn't have been done without that effort, that kind of flips the script on things. It's not just putting up billboards. It's not just running ads. There's a lot more to it. And you can get really creative with even those things that I just mentioned, but you can be really strategic and creative. And I like that side of it a lot. But most people that are not deep into marketing that try it don't come out with very creative stuff. So it comes out very stuffy. It's not not interesting whatsoever. It's kind of what everybody else does. So that's a hard skill. Like it takes a really long time to realize what everybody else is doing and that you should not do that. Because in any profession, you're just kind of told like, here's best practices, do this, you'll be fine. But usually it's actually best to know that stuff and then go the opposite direction. And for marketing, that's definitely true. Most people that don't get marketing, that don't do it well, it's only because they're just doing what everybody else is doing. That's not going to work ever. Why would it? If 7 billion people are doing the same exact thing, all it takes is like one person to walk the other direction and they get all the attention because they actually stand out, but people aren't willing to do that for whatever reason.
You need to learn the rules before you break them. And once you break them, then it's like, oh wow, that was genius.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
100%. Yeah. Like anything that I've ever done that people think is cool, it's just cause like I can just easily say, yeah, cause I know what works and what doesn't. And I know I understand that deeply, but I also just don't care. And I show that I don't care. And that's why you think it's interesting, because it looks like maybe a little different than something you've seen before. The barrier to entry in marketing is still so low. People are so bad at it. Like even marketers, we're bad at it a lot of the time. You can't hit 1,000. You sometimes you bat 200, you know, 2%, 3%, whatever. It's not possible to just nail it out of the park every single time, but that's what people try to do. And then it ends up just coming across as boring and ordinary.
What's something that someone could do right now? Obviously very broad, but give someone something that they could potentially latch onto and use as a marketer for whatever they're marketing.
Yeah. I would say, one of the cool things that I try to do, especially with outreach, this is a big thing in marketing. You're going to reach out to people. You're going to try to talk to people all the time and get your message out there. Try to find people where they are at, but where they're not the most popular. So for example, Danny, what's your biggest platform? Is it Twitter?
Yeah.
Okay. So I know that you're really generous with your DMs and you'll respond, but let's say that all of a sudden you're at 100K followers and it's no longer tenable to be in your DMs all the time and respond to everything, because it'll get to that point. If that's the case, and I want to get on Danny Miranda's show, and you're not reaching out to me, I'm trying to pitch to you, then I have two options. I can either go on Twitter and try my luck at getting into your DMs and having it actually seen, or I can go to another platform where I know that you're there and paying attention at least, but you're not super big yet. So like, I'm going to check out Danny on TikTok. And I'm going to try to get a hold of him on TikTok.
Hmm.
Then you've got like 600 followers and you're going to be paying attention to the DMs because you're not getting a ton of them. So you see a notification from TikTok and you're like, I never get these. What is this? That's one thing that you need to meet people where they're at for sure. But again, zag just a little bit and try to meet them where they're at, but not popular, because then you can actually get their attention. That's a big problem with email. You try cold emailing people. Sometimes it works. Most of the time it doesn't. People hate checking their email now. So take that into account. But also they get more email than probably anything else. So you're going to get lost in there. Find a way to get into an inbox that is not as crowded.
I love that tip. And on the email point, I want to add something, which is that I found that adding attachments that are relevant to that person when sending cold emails is a useful tactic. I just wanted to add that for anyone listening.
No, that's definitely true too. And the reason why is because it creates some level of personability. Like, you're personalizing that email a little bit more the more you add onto it. So the more that it looks like it didn't just come from my, you know, basically spam from some kind of automation, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to ask you about, you know, you changed your Twitter name from UX Blake to Hey Blake. And I'm curious what went into that decision.
When I really started creating on Twitter, I was trying to do Instagram at the same time. And that's a whole different story. But that's the username that I chose because I've been a firm believer my whole career since I've really understood SEO, that user experience and SEO were actually under the same bucket and they should be talked together a lot more than they really are. And so I was doing a lot of conversion rate optimization, which has direct ties to user experience. And I've been doing audit. I've done like 400, 500 audits of people's landing pages for this stuff. And so that's kind of my bread and butter. And I thought, okay, UX Blake is available. So that was key because it's really hard to find an available handle. And then next was, I think that UX is interesting in the marketing space because most people aren't thinking of it that way. So maybe that's a unique thing for me. And maybe I can help more people understand the importance of user experience in marketing itself. So that was kind of why I picked that username first. But a few months ago, I just, my audience started growing and I started becoming a lot less known for that stuff and a lot more for like creator economy stuff. And a lot of people know me as an engagement person. Like, that's what they really call me when they're referring to me to their friends on Twitter. They're like, he's really good at engagement. He's the engagement guy. And I never call myself that, but that was interesting that they picked my niche for me kind of, and I kind of started running with that. So I figured I need to be a little bit more general because I'm not a UX designer. And that's what a lot of people, I would get DMs saying, hey, do you have any like spots for UX design projects? And I'd have to say, no, I don't do that. I don't know what I'm doing there. So I felt like eventually it became a misnomer and I had to change it to be something general. And I just kept it general because I didn't want to have to do it again, basically. So if I do niche down again, that's cool. At least I can just have a generic handle that people know me for, but I don't have to change it every single time something changes. It's just there. So that's the brief story there.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you mentioned you've done 400 to 500 website audits. What are some of the common mistakes you see in a website?
Way too complicated. That's the main one. If you, and I put a tweet out today about this, actually, the more complex something, or the more simple something looks, the more complex the work was that went into it. So it does, the reason why so many landing pages are very complicated is because people just throw everything that they know about that topic on the landing page. And then that's what it is, because it would be a lot harder to make it simple, weirdly enough. But that's the biggest one, like just having way too much stuff. If you're just trying to get signups for a product, just do that. Like, just have a button that says sign up. Here are some details, maybe a little bit more social proof or a little bit more context, but it doesn't have to be crazy. You don't have to have the whole thing fleshed out. That's a huge one. I've audited, I would say like a tenth of the websites I've audited didn't even have a focused call to action. As crazy as that sounds, like no clear button. It's just guessing. They would have their email opt-in as their hero button, but that had nothing to do with what they were trying to do. Like, they didn't even care about their newsletter, but they put it up there because other people do that, I guess. So why not? That's a terrible reason to put a call to action like that up there. So I could go on and on about this stuff, honestly. I've seriously done hundreds of these things and I have them in a Loom folder and it takes me forever to scroll through the list because I've done so many of them, but I don't know. I could go on and on. I don't want to bore you with technicalities here unless you want me to.
Well, it's not boring at all to me, but what makes a good website? Like what makes something that you're like, wow, that was amazing. The opposite of the mistakes.
Yeah, the question you really should be asking yourself is, am I delighting the user here? Would I be delighted to use this? And that boils down to a lot of its design, a lot of its copy. You can't use really boring copy that everybody else uses. You need to find a way to differentiate to tell a story. Just don't make it look like all the other copy out there. Also, another big one is make it about them, not about you. Another big mistake that I see people making is they're the ones that build their own websites, so they have absolutely no filter for their bias. So it all comes through on the landing page. And basically what you see is all this complicated jargon that the owner of the website thinks is what the reader wants. But in reality, it's like 5 degrees more difficult to read and deeper than they actually want it to be. You need to simplify like crazy, just simplify layer upon layer until you get to something that a sixth grader can understand. That's the lens you should be looking through. But the bias is crazy. It's very strong in some of these website owners. And that's a big one. So if you can make the website all about the user and what they want, which usually means simplifying, answering their questions, giving them free stuff, just ask, what can I do to make this about them? And then the second layer would be, okay, now it's all about them. Now, what elements can I add on to delight them? Would that be a cooler design that maybe they haven't seen? Would that be funnier copy? Would it be just, I mean, most of the time it just means having a really great product, but on the front end, you don't necessarily get to see that a ton. So show the product in action a little bit more on the front of the page, but there's so much you can do. But if you boil it down to making it about them and delighting them after that, you really can't have a terrible landing page with that formula, but you can still do a lot more to make it great.
So when you take a website and want to make it good to great, what are those few things that make it great?
Interactions, like interactive content. So instead of just having everything plain, make stuff GIFs of screenshots or GIFs of the software in action. Have a lot of social proof that's engaging. So video screenshots or video social proof, testimonials, stuff like that. And then interactions, like when you hover over things, they do fun things, like they explode confetti. And, you know, like there are a lot of examples of that stuff, but people like that. And you can really find ways to delight people. And when you get to that point, the hard thing is there's a reason that there's so few great landing pages compared to good ones, because at that point, there's nothing major you can do to make it great. It's a lot of really, really small things that you can do that eventually make it great. And so you have to be willing to basically look at a very good product, a very good landing page, and then add on tons of tiny things over time for it to become great. And that takes a lot of work and a lot of brain power. And most people aren't willing to do that. So you can create a great landing page, but it's probably going to take just as much time to get it from zero to very good as it will from very good to great.
That's very interesting. I've never actually thought about it like that. Switching gears here, I've noticed that you have so many different projects, and I went to look you up on Spotify doing research for this conversation. I come up with maybe like 4 or 5 different podcasts that you've started and created. Yeah. And it was shocking to me. And you also have such a long-term mindset. You know, I've listened to podcasts where you've said, you know, I want to be the person known for something in 10 years. And I'm thinking long-term. I'm not trying to cash in right away. Like, that's how you're thinking. But at the same time, you're trying so many different things and your hands are in so many different buckets. How do you think about that juxtaposition?
I think the reason why I say that I'm thinking long-term is because that's not naturally who I am. And I'm trying to will it into existence. So like I'll say on a podcast or I'll say on Twitter, I'm going for 10 years from now, or I'm going to try this thing and I'm hoping that I'll be consistent with it, knowing that my natural inclination is to start a lot of things and give up on all of them. So it's more trying to manifest something out there. And some things have stuck for a longer period of time. And then you'll see like most of those podcasts out there are not active right now. They've all died somewhere along the way, except for How I Built My Audience, which right now, guess what, is totally on hold because I'm super busy. So this stuff happens and I have room built in to forgive myself when I do have to kill a project or I need to stall on it. But I try to put things out there that hold me accountable, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I'm not really scared of backlash or anything, because ultimately I really believe that nobody cares about you for a very, very, very long time. And then when they do, they'll forgive you for anything if you're just providing value. So it's not really scary to build in public that way, or to make projects that flop 2 weeks in and I just totally give up on them. I think that's it's actually a good power that I have, is the ability to recognize when it's time to quit something or when it's not. Like, you know, maybe if I'd stuck with some of those, they would have actually turned into something great and I missed out on an opportunity there. It's very possible. But I believe that I've been focusing on the right things, but I just try new stuff all the time because that's interesting to me and it's fun. And then from there, whatever happens, happens. But it's a little bit different now. I've got this new product coming out, and that is not going to be the same, because like I have hundreds of people on the wait list for that are counting on me to launch. So it's a little bit different. So when something like that happens, that's going to be there consistently because I've built in accountability and basically no option but to ship. But a lot of these podcasts and stuff like that are just experiments.
Yeah, that's cool. And I appreciate the transparency on that. So what are the defining characteristics of things you've stuck with?
Money, interest to me, creative, ability to be creative on a regular basis. And if it's helping people, I guess, are some of the main filters. Like the money side is cool because it gives you an idea of clearly, should I start, should I keep going, or should I stop? But then that's kind of where that ends, because you get to a certain point, you don't rely as much on money from a very small project to like supplement any part of your life. So that's not a huge driving factor, but does it help people? Is like, I can tell if something's helping people because they will engage without me even prompting them on Twitter or wherever else. So if I'm creating something that people want, they will tell me about it without me even having to ask. And that's really cool. If I create something that actually sucks, they will tell me through their silence, which has also happened. I launched this thing. So I mentioned the website audits I've been doing forever. Clearly there was demand for that because I've been doing them for a long time. I created this other product through Gumroad that was basically a way to take some of that information and put it into a simple dashboard. So I call that UX dashboards, and it would just tell you at an overview how good your website was in terms of its user experience at that given moment. I thought it was going to be great because it was cheaper than the audit and I could do more of them. And it sounded like a great idea. And then I put it out and the audience resoundedly, they just told me in a big roar through their silence that they didn't want that. Like nobody ordered that thing. Nobody wanted it. Nobody talked about it. So that's the flip side of that too, that they just tell you what they want, what they don't want, pretty honestly. And then you just kind of run with it.
Most people, I don't know if most people is the right word, but it's like, that's very easy to stop at that point and say like, oh, you know what? No one likes my product. I suck at Twitter. I suck at giving people what they want. What made you not quit?
I almost quit Twitter in September. I was pretty close. My journey with Twitter is like 2013, 2014. I get back from my mission. I get on Twitter, but it seemed really boring and like I didn't need it. So I created the account, but didn't use it for 7 years. And then I got back on in July of 2020 was when I really started. And I probably had a few, like 700 followers in July when I started. And most of those were spam or family or whatever. So no audience whatsoever. And within a couple months, it was going okay. And I saw a little bit of traction, but it was like, I thought it was the hardest thing in the world to get a like on Twitter, because honestly it is. It's super hard to get likes on Twitter. But I was going from zero at that time. And then in September, I had like 4 or 5 people liking my stuff on Twitter. And I thought that was super cool. But at the same time, I was like, I just put so much effort into this and I'm still only getting 4 or 5 likes and hardly any new followers ever. And I was about to quit in September. I have no clue why I didn't. I just kept posting stuff begrudgingly for a while until like eventually, like December, I had a couple big posts that hit and I started getting more followers. And since then, it's been a really consistent stream and it's been cool. And now I'm you know, 11 and a half, about to hit 12K. So it's like a pretty decent audience to grow from July. That wouldn't have happened because I was about to quit. But I can't honestly just say like I'm impervious and I'm an Iron Man and nothing dissuades me from like, I could probably still be persuaded to leave Twitter under the right circumstances at this point. I need to grow stronger and build my foundation a little firmer there. But yeah, it's just like blind posting constantly, just putting out content, listening to Gary Vee, just doing all that crap. And just not letting myself quit, even though I wanted to so bad, because I recognized the value of it pretty quickly when I got back on. I just didn't think I was getting any of the value. I thought it was still out there, but then I started capturing it.
Well, Twitter's the reason why you have your new job. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah.
So how did that come to be?
Well, so I've often said the past year that LinkedIn was responsible for the first like 6 years of my career, but I believe that Twitter would be responsible for the rest of it. And I believe that that's holding up so far. I think that's true so far. When I started growing faster in December into January, I was getting noticed by more and more people. And then Paul Yacoubian, the CEO of Copy AI, and Chris Liu, the co-founder, started noticing me a little bit, and we just chatted in DMs. And he was like, "Hey, what's up? Do you want to do marketing for us?" And I was like, "I don't know. Let me think about it." And so I was actually pretty happy at my job at the time. I was working for a company called Talkdesk, and I was a senior manager there with a team and working with people across the world. And it was pretty cool. Kind of a boring industry, but interesting work still, and good people to work with. And so I wasn't really looking to go anywhere, but eventually Paul was just like, "Yeah, you can be our CMO. Do you want to come on board?" And I did. It was pretty quick, honestly. Like I just had to make sure with my wife that we were going to have insurance, and then we were good. So that was like the big blocker, but it was a very quick process, because when you meet the right people that share your values and an exciting product is attached to that, it's really easy to make that decision. And that's something that a lot of people don't get. And I'm very, very lucky and grateful for that opportunity, because I know that doesn't just happen a lot of the time to people. But I believe that the reason that I got noticed initially was because I was just trying to give everything away that I knew. I wasn't selling consulting on the side to upsell, wasn't doing anything else. I was just sharing like, "Hey, I've been in marketing for 7 years. It's not that long, but it's pretty long compared to some of you. Here's how you can have some modicum of success in marketing early in your career. Here's how you can launch a product. I'll show you how to do that. I'll show you how to not do that. I'll show you all kinds of different unique ways to use Twitter or other social media." And that's what I did for free. And I started getting noticed, and that's really how it happened. So yeah, if I had stopped in September, my life would be a little bit different at this point, I think it's safe to say. And I'm glad that I didn't.
So I read somewhere that it was only 3 Zoom calls you and Paul had before actually making the switch. What was discussed in those 3 Zoom calls?
Very little, honestly. the cool thing about this opportunity, like I mentioned, it was just super easy to make the decision, because I have never had the opportunity to market a product that I actually used, as crazy as that sounds. My whole career has been at Boostability, that SEO firm where we were doing spammy backlinks. And then agency life, where I was working with a bunch of different clients, mostly in boring industries. And they paid us well, but they were really demanding. And so that was like very taxing on your mental health and everything. Then I moved to Talkdesk. Well, in between all of this, I'd been doing consulting and side work for like this entire time. So I was learning a lot more there than I was in my jobs usually. And then I moved to Talkdesk, and you know, it was a really good experience managing a team and adding that on and everything, but kind of just lost my train of thought. leading up until that point, Talkdesk is a call center software, and I'm one human being, so I can never use call center software. That doesn't make sense. I never got to use the tool. So leading up until this point, it's just been a lot of other people's stuff that other people care about, and I'm responsible for marketing it. This time, it was a tool that I had already played around with and really liked, and I could see the groundbreaking potential of that tool. So first and foremost, before even talking to them, I thought it was cool. which planted the seed. Like, I would be able to market something that I use using the tool to market the tool. Like, I can create copy to promote copy AI. That's pretty cool. So there's like this loop of just really cool possibilities there. And then when I met Paul and Chris, they're just really energetic, nice people with a big, big vision. And you've talked to Paul, so he's like a wacky inflatable arm flailing tube man. That's how I describe him. He's one of those like in the parking lot of the car salesman. He's just like always waving around and, you know, high energy guy. And so it was really easy to be sold on that culture because the vision was so huge and I was going to be able to do really, really cool things with this. So yeah, very few Zoom calls, only maybe three, maybe even two. I don't know. Maybe my memory failed already, but it was pretty short. Just like, get to know you. What do you think about the product? What do you think about the future of this stuff? And then it was a whole lot of me saying, yeah, Paul, I don't have any idea what AI is. And then he's like, that's okay. We'll get you up to speed. That was pretty much what it was. And then we figured out the terms and it was set. So it happened really quickly.
Yeah. And what have you enjoyed most about the job so far?
It's challenging because we're starting from complete scratch. I was hire number one. So I had no reference point. There was no onboarding process. There was no marketing department, no marketing efforts. It was all word of mouth. And so that was actually really cool for me because I got to help build out the onboarding process and I'm helping build out the culture. And that's not even touching on any marketing stuff. Then I get into marketing. There's zero there, but we need to be at like 37 from zero. And so you have to make that leap super quickly. And a lot of the marketing department gets to take my personality and my vision, which is an opportunity that I haven't had before, really. It's always been fitting into somebody else's vision. And that's been super exciting. I'm not going to lie and say that it's not without its stressors too. It's a lot to think like I own this entire wing of this company that could potentially be big. And if I don't inject the right personality and the right culture and processes into this wing that I'm building, then it could flop. But at the same time, you just plow ahead, hire the best people, work with the other leaders in the company, the other people in the company, and we're just all figuring it out together. So it is less than structured day by day. And I like that. It's really fun because every single day it's like new things to do. And there are a million different directions. And the core thing that we're learning is just how to focus on one or two. So any tips there? I'm all ears, but we're doing an okay job and just trying to narrow that focus more and more.
Where do you look for to advice when you're building something completely from scratch?
My own failures mostly because a lot doesn't exist. I've tried looking up stuff on like on YouTube. I Googled what is a CMO or what does a CMO do? And it's like a bunch of 60-year-old CMOs that have done really traditional marketing and none of it applies to me anymore. So that's not super helpful. So it's just trying to figure out with Paul and Chris and the rest of the team what we want to try out and then setting up experiments. And a lot of the times they hit, a lot of the times they fail. And you learn from that stuff. Like that's why I'm building in public, honestly, is so I can have a record of this to look back on and say, this is what worked or what didn't work. And this is why or why not. Because when I look out at the current resources, there's some people on Twitter that I follow that help me a ton. And I ask questions a lot to try to get, I don't try to pretend like I know what I'm doing. I don't. So I'm asking often questions that can help me get better at one specific thing. And that helps a ton, but it's also a lot of different voices that are saying different things. So you don't really know which ones to pay attention to and whatnot. So honestly, I don't have a reference point. I just have to be my own. And that is tough.
What are some of the successes that of the experiments that you've run so far that you can share?
Yeah. So growth is up still. That's the number one success. Everything we're doing is contributing to higher monthly recurring revenue, more free customers signing up. And we're building out right now a more robust onboarding process to help that free to paid conversion rate go up as well. That's another big goal because there are a lot of people that we have over 100,000 users now. But obviously, we don't have 100,000 paid users. And so improving the conversion rate of people that sign up for a free trial to paying customers is very top of mind. And so right now, we're running an experiment currently to improve the onboarding process, to get more information persona-wise out of that process so that we can send better onboarding emails and get them more engaged from the get-go and teach them the tool a lot better. Like that's the big thing that we're focusing on in almost every experiment is around education, because people think that AI is scary and it's going to take their job and then it's going to come to their house and saw their door down and steal their family. And that's not what's going to happen. If you know, we believe the future is very bright and the future doesn't have to suck like a lot of people think. And so that helps us to have some kind of idea, like whenever we're experimenting, we can push the limits of AI without it having to be scary or anything like that. But getting back to this education piece, people just have different ideas of what the tool should be than what our vision is, or they don't understand AI really, which is like copy AI is not supposed to be your only copywriter that takes over everything and takes people's jobs. It helps people create more stuff, helps people make a business easier, start a website more quickly. That's what the purpose is. It's a supplement, a very, very good supplement, I might add, but it's not a replacer. And so everything we're experimenting on is basically in that early education phase of when they either don't know the product yet or sign up for the product. We need to educate them to be a more advanced, engaged user from the get-go, which hasn't been there. So that's a current one that we're really focusing on. For a past one, I've only been here a month, but so far, like hiring has actually been one of the big experiments that is paying out really, really well. Like I've hired two people now to the team. Didn't think it was going to be that quick to get people on the marketing team, honestly, but we just decided to go for it. And it's been working out really well just because I didn't realize how many different directions I could take this thing. And having somebody to focus on one without me having to worry about it is huge, because before I was doing that thing too. So that's one of the best experiments so far. I would say marketing wise, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of any of this stuff yet. It's all been infrastructure, logistics, onboarding, all that stuff, getting the company up to speed. And just now we're getting people on the team where we can actually start marketing more aggressively.
What are some of the traits you're looking for in people you're hiring?
Creativity is a big one. It really helps when people are building in public and it's easy to see what they're all about and what they believe and what they know and what they don't know. That's really appealing in a candidate, because I don't need to look at your resume, which resumes don't really tell you much anymore anyway. They never really did. Like, I can look at your LinkedIn and get an idea of what companies you've worked for, but I don't know if that means you're going to be a good fit for my company. And I don't get any sense of your personality or how you actually work. I just get the title. So when people are building in public and openly being creative, it's really easy to see right off the bat, like, oh yeah, that person's super talented. We want that person. You know, with Austin, who we just hired as our video lead, he does not have a big audience yet. And he has a YouTube channel with like 5 videos. But if you look at the videos, they're freaking great. They're awesome. And I would have never found him without a Twitter thread. I don't even know where it was, just some random Twitter thread where his name got brought up and I checked it out and then watched all his videos. But within 5 minutes, I'm like, oh yeah, okay. So he can do exactly what we need to tell our story. I don't get that from a resume. So I would say the number one thing is build in public. That's what you can do. Create stuff openly. If you do that, you have a better chance of getting hired because people can actually tell who you are. So the interview process is shortened like crazy. Everybody gets aligned more quickly with values and everything. And it just makes the whole process so much smoother.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a huge one. So I want to talk about, you know, way back in your journey, you got thrown into the waters of, I believe, the agency that you were working at. And how do you think that that impacted your current reality and helping you today?
Yeah. Are you referencing when I joined an agency and then got thrown into a management position on the interim?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yeah. So my first agency that I worked at, I got hired and didn't think that I was qualified to get that job. And I got it and I was really happy about it. Got started in SEO. And then we had this director of SEO that was there for a few weeks where we overlapped. And my job was not to be a director of SEO. My job was to be like the scrub SEO, barely above an intern, barely getting paid type of guy. Like that was my job. And I was working with the SEO director because we were the only two people just dedicated to that in the company. A lot of agencies have like very siloed approaches where they have an entire SEO team or an entire paid search team or whatever. This was more like everybody was expected to have a few different skill sets and we all just kind of helped each other out. And then you just worked on teams. So that was more of what I was thrown into there. And there were not very many SEO people in there. So I was working directly with him, coming up with a bunch of processes and strategies and stuff. And then he got fired without me knowing. And I was the only other SEO person there. So for a short while, it wasn't very long, but for a short while, I was the only SEO person there, which meant that I was in the interim managing the SEO strategy and processes for our company. And thankfully, there were still other people doing the SEO specialist work on the different teams for the different clients. But when it came to like processes and strategies and stuff, it was on me. And I was probably a year and a half to 2 years into my career and still had no clue what was going on. So I made a bunch of stuff up. I tried to learn as quickly as I could about what we should be doing strategy-wise. And it was awesome and brutal. As like, that's what agency life is. It is brutal, but it can also be really awesome for your learning. And that experience was the most hands-on thing that I've ever had happen to me that just catapulted me probably an extra year or two ahead of my career than I actually was, because people were just looking to me to do stuff. And thankfully, props to that whole team there too, because I know that I was being handheld a little bit because I just was not qualified whatsoever to do that. But people actually listened to what I thought and what I said. And that also was a huge part of this. I felt empowered to do more work along the lines of what I was doing, because even in a time where I was clearly unqualified, people were listening to me and taking my advice and working with me on this stuff. And that was huge. You don't get a lot of feel-good moments in agency life, honestly, because even when you get good results, the client wanted more and they'll bite your head off. So this is one of the few times where I just had like a heartwarming time with my colleagues. I was actually in an agency setting able to grow. And there were a lot of rough times too during there that I probably blocked out of my memory. But yeah, it was super valuable.
Yeah. And it's now like come full circle, at least appears from the outside, where you are in the role of leading a team again, but you have more experience and are better able to navigate mm-hmm. the waters.
Yeah. I think one of the big things now, I obviously understand a lot more about marketing, and I'm not just an SEO person now. I've really expanded to be able to touch a lot of different facets of marketing at this point. But I think my biggest advantage is I know really well how to search for stuff now. And I didn't know how to do that before. When I was in that position, I didn't know what to look for to help me be better. And now I have access to people that I know I can rely on to help me when I'm just not doing well. I have access to Twitter, which I didn't have an audience there before to get valuable feedback. I just know how to Google stuff better now to learn what I don't know. So that's a huge part of it too. Yeah, there's tons more experience. I've gone through a lot since then. I feel like there are a couple different inflection points in my career that, like I mentioned before, have advanced me further in my career than I actually was. So I feel like I've probably got more like 15 years of experience in marketing than I, you know, but I really have like 7 or 8. So that's, yeah, you can't deny that the experience really counts, but it's all like the savoir faire of the other stuff, the knowing how to get help, knowing what to search, knowing when to, or at least being comfortable just saying, I have no clue. That's been a huge part for me too. Because early on in my career, no way you were catching me saying, I don't know. If somebody, even at my first job on my first day, when someone would ask me, do you know how to do this link building thing? I'd be like, yes, I would say yes. And then I would freak out and try to figure it out. And I would figure it out eventually and ask more questions. But now I'm just like, I had no clue. Let's figure it out. I'm a little bit more confident in what I don't know.
Do you think that was to your benefit back in the day? Because when you're young and inexperienced, it's helpful to just say yes to everything.
To a point, yeah. I think it did help me for the most part, like overall. But on a case-by-case basis, I'm sure there were a lot of chances to actually learn something. I was definitely the type of person early on in my career that missed out on really learning processes and how to do things because I was too prideful to just say, I don't know. So there, I probably could have learned a lot quicker if I would have just admitted it. But at the same time, I may not have come across as confident and ready for the next step along the way. So maybe it would have taken me a little bit longer to get where I am in terms of a title, but knowledge-wise, I might actually be further ahead.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds like Joe DeSena once talked to me. I had a podcast with him and he said, you know, Navy SEALs who have been through some harder training don't have as hard of a handshake. And they're not trying to prove anything. It was the point. Mm. And it sounds like that's similar to what you're going through today, whereas like you're not trying to prove anything. You're comfortable with what you don't know and you just want to learn. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's a lot more about proving to myself at this point than it is to proving others. I feel like I've been written off a lot of my life that I was going to be fine, but nothing special. And so, you know, there was for a long time in my early on in my career, I wanted to make more money. I wanted to have the better title. I wanted all these things because I really wanted other people to know. I wanted Danny to know that I was a CMO back then. That's what I wanted. But now what I really want to know is, can I crush this and still be a great dad? That's what I want to know.
Where does that transition come from?
Having kids will innately do that a little bit. That was a big one. Just like all of a sudden feeling like, oh, I don't have not nearly as much time to do everything. I've got a lot more to juggle now. It kind of builds itself in, but I don't know how to answer that fully though. Beyond that, like I'm just at this point and somewhere along the way, the gradient started fading more black where it was more gray to white earlier on. Like I don't know when that really took place.
It sounds like, what do you think was the cause for just feeling like you had something to prove?
Well, probably just family stuff. I mean, to be honest, my dad has worked a career that he hates for, you know, 30 years. So that was one motivator. Is just not wanting to do that. Like I have tons of respect for him because he did that so he could support the family. But I never in a million years wanted myself to just do something for the sake of making money. Especially because when you do that, you usually make less money because you're not willing to take a risk. So that was a motivator. But then, you know, throughout my life, I was just kind of like this, I was bullied for being a redhead, which is weird. Like, I don't understand why you get bullied for that. But like all through elementary, middle school was bullied. That kind of got to my head. And I think, you know, when I got into high school as a sophomore, I didn't really hit my stride. And at that point, it was a pretty transitional period for me, sophomore to junior year of high school, where I didn't feel like, so for context, my mom died when I was 9. And then my dad got remarried a couple times. He got remarried to, he's still with the second remarriage now. And that happened when I was a junior in high school, I believe. And from that point on, he actually moved to his new bride's house. And that was about 20 minutes away. And my brother and I were just left in the old house because my brother was about to go on his mission. And I was still in high school. So we were living alone in this house. And there were just, I guess, a lot of doubt at that time crept in. Like, what am I going to do? It seems like a lot of stuff is kind of stacked against me right now. Looking back, it really wasn't that bad, but in the moment it was terrible. And so at that moment, I think I decided like, I want to be way more than people think I'm going to be. And so then going into senior year, I was like, I'm going to do student government. And so I ran for student government, and that's an interesting story of like my first real foray into marketing. Actually, we can get into that a little bit if you want to, but I became the senior class president after having no experience in student government before. So that was my first step. I'm like, I'm going to do something with my life. Joke's on me because right now I'm currently planning my 10-year reunion. So I regret everything and I regret being the senior class president, but at that time was like, I'm going to do something. And so that was the first step. And then I mentioned on my mission, there were leadership positions, and that's where I was the whole time. Leadership positions, whether they were small up to like the top leadership position in the entire mission, I was there. And the reason why was probably a little bit selfish and more motivated by like wanting to be seen as powerful than actually being helpful. And I think I've changed a little bit since then, for sure. For sure, I've changed a lot since then, because now I'm not like going around saying, hey, I'm a CMO. You know, like nobody, my family does no clue what I do. They have no clue and they don't care. And my friends have no clue what I do.
So going back to that experience that for the student government, what happened there?
Yeah. So everybody, my high school is very big. Our class was like 1200 people. And so I already was working, I was working against all odds to be elected, because a lot of the people that were running were staple names in student government since like middle school. Everybody knew these people. They were the popular ones. And I was just like, I was just this quirky kid, and I had some friends, and I was like, I wasn't popular, but I, you know, people knew me. They thought I was funny. That's fine. That's what they thought I was. And so I was like, I got to do something weird with this campaign, because most people get the big poster boards and they'll just put vote for Haley, vote for Amanda, whatever. And that's it. And I was not going to do that. So instead, I limited my posters to a single piece of paper size for every poster. I kept them super small. And then my whole campaign was based on a farce. So I have a picture of me when I was a baby, and I was just a monster. I was so fat as a baby. And so I got that picture put on a t-shirt, and my whole campaign slogan was, vote for Blake and together we'll fight childhood obesity. And that was, that was my campaign all the way throughout. And I don't know where the t-shirt, I think I still have one, but I would just wear that t-shirt every day. I would just wash it after school and wear it the next day for like 2 weeks. And then on my posters, I would make puns about Pokemon or Harry Potter or whatever we were into at the time. And it was just all on tiny little pieces of paper. And I just spammed the school with this funny crap that barely even said to vote for me most of the time. People just knew that I made it. And then when it got to voting time, I captured like 97% of the vote. You could vote for like four people, I think. 97% of the people voted for me at least one time. So it's like, wow, cool. And so then I got, you know, that's just to get elected as an officer. The title comes after, and you go through a bunch of interviews with the counselor that's in charge. And then I was elected the president. So pretty cool. But when I look back, I had no clue that was marketing. I just thought I was being funny. And then I look back and like, hey, I have a clear first story for when I really did marketing well. It's kind of cool.
It's crazy, because that is what you saw with GameStop, and what you saw with Dogecoin is memeing, creating something and actually changing people and changing people's opinions and changing people. So it's crazy that you were doing that 10 years ago. You were memeing before it was cool.
I had no idea. I had no idea. And I didn't realize it until like a year ago even. But now I'm just like, that's cool. I even wrote a blog about it, because I realized it was cool way too late. But that, you know, there was a reason that worked, because it was just, again, like I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, it was upon the same foundation as the other campaigns that other people were running. Like I was still promoting with paper and with pen, but the way that I was doing it was way different. Like it was hard to read my stuff. So like, I don't know what your high school looked like, but there were pillars in the middle of the hallways, and the hallways were really, really wide. So there was a pillar in between all of them, like every 20 feet. Every pillar had mine right there. Nobody was using these because they didn't usually get too much foot traffic, because our high school was so spread out that, you know, there was enough, like people weren't very crowded in there. People were using the common area like crazy. So in the common area, you go in there and it's just plastered with these huge posters. You go into the hallways, that's where I was. I was just off in the nether regions of the school with these tiny pieces of paper. And I started noticing people huddling around the columns where they would never do that before. And they were just looking at my stupid post, my piece of paper, and it was hard to read. And that resonated. Like you get one person exposure to that one time, they're voting for you, guaranteed. And I didn't realize that. But, you know, those principles kind of stuck with me, I guess.
It's going where people are not, but it's the small area. It's the secondary source, like you were saying before. Yep. And you were doing that way back 10 years ago. Incredible.
Yeah, it was a fun time.
So I'd like to wrap this conversation up, Blake. This has been an incredible fun and incredible time. I'm really gracious for your time. Do you have anything else you'd like to discuss or anything else you'd like to mention before we come to a final close?
Well, first off, thank you, Danny, for having me on. This is awesome. I hopefully get somewhere close to what Gary Vee got in terms of listens. I'm sure that that's probably not going to happen. I'm funnier than Gary Vee, by the way. I think people should know that. Gary Vee is fine, but I'm funnier than Gary Vee. So if you're not if you're following Gary Vee, but not me, this is what you're getting. But on a more serious note, yeah, thank you for having me on. Just want to plug really quick a couple things that I'm working on, if I may. Obviously, Copy AI, which has already been mentioned, copy.ai is the URL. It's just a tool that helps you create more stuff. So for example, if you're creating a landing page and you don't know what to put for the title or the header or whatever, you can put your ideas in this and it'll actually help you generate a really good header. And it does that for like 30 different other tools right now. So it's pretty robust. And that's where I work on the CMO there. And then also working on a side project with my coworker at Copy AI. His name is Zach. And we're working on something called Float, which is an online course builder that is built on top of Notion. So if you've ever used like Super to create a website from a Notion page, this takes it to the next level and actually lets you host an entire course formatted like you would expect it, all the functions that you would expect from an online course builder. And you can do it all from Notion, basically. So wherever you're taking notes in Notion, you can just push that into an online course immediately. So that's what we're working on as well. And outside of that, I am happy to answer any other questions, any lightning rounds, anything else that you want, or to close up here, but just happy that I was able to be on.
Yeah, Blake, this has been incredible fun. With Float specifically, what got you so excited about this project?
I've had the idea for like 3 months and I sat on it and I was planning on doing something with it and talked to a few developers and they were excited, but didn't think it could be done very easily. And then just decided to do it when I met Zach, because he actually built Potion Pages, which is very similar to Super. He built something like that and already had this whole set of code built for that first part of it. And he's like, yeah, we can do this. It's going to be great. And so when he was on board, I was full steam ahead to revive this thing. But yeah, it almost died. If I hadn't met him, it probably would have died. What really excites me about it is a couple things. First off, I am creating courses pretty often, and I've hosted a course of my own on Notion using Super to make it into a website. But you're missing out on like being able to mark your progress or gate the content or get paid for it or any of that stuff. So it's not really an online course so much as just a bigger blog. And that didn't really work for me. Another part of it is when I started the Twitter MBA, which I'm also building out right now, I was looking at stuff like Podia, and they have all the functions you want. It's a great software. The problem is that Twitter MBA is going to be free and Podia's plans start at $40 a month for the base plan. And they're like $80 a month for the plan that you probably actually need. And I think that $80 a month is a bit unreasonable for a lot of creators, especially if you're just starting out and want to create your first course. It's really hard to use anything like that. And Podia is they're like one of the cheaper ones. So that was a big pain point for me. I'm like, we got to make this easier for people to just push publish on the stuff that they're building. And if we host it on Notion, because the CMS is, we can use that as a CMS and it's all built there, we can make this way cheaper for people and have all the same functionality. And they don't have to copy and paste their notes from what they're building from Notion into Podia. They just push publish and it's live instantly. So there are a lot of reasons to do it. It's mostly selfish because this is one of those rare ideas that I actually have this problem and it frustrates me so much. So I'm building it. That's one of those.
Well, I'm looking forward to checking it out. I'm on the wait list for it to come out. And the link for that will be in the show notes as well as all the links that you mentioned. Blake, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for having this conversation with me. And it's been very fascinating to learn more about you.
Appreciate you. And yeah, let me know if you just have to cut the whole episode, that's fine. I understand. but this was fun. I had a good time. Thank you, Danny.
Just want to send you a quick thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening until the final seconds. I truly appreciate it. You can expect new episodes of this podcast Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. If you have any thoughts about the episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. Until then, I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.